This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
This week, we're going to take a different tack in our Lifetime Income series. We're going to take a look at probate and estate taxes and also successor trustees. Joining me on the program is Roberta J. Robinson. She's a certified specialist and lawyer specializing in probate, estate, and trust law. Roberta, you know, for as long as I used to do planning, you had this certainty when it came to estate taxes. You knew what the exclusion amount was. You knew what the tax rate was, and it pretty much remained pretty static. Over the last couple of years, we saw in 2010, if you died, there were no estate taxes. Now we have a situation where this year the exemption is $5,120,000 that you can pass without any estate taxes, and the rate's 35%. Next year, if nothing changes, it's due to drop to from $5 million down to $1 million and 55%. Is this created a lot more uncertainty, and does it make your job a little tougher when we don't know exactly where the laws are going to be?
It definitely makes things tougher. We do know what the law will be, and I keep trying to hammer home this message with my own clients. We will only have a $1 million exemption starting January 1st unless Congress and the President change the law. We're in an election year, and I think with great certainty we can say the law will not be changed by January 1st. So people are just now waking up to the fact that there's going to be a very large estate tax on anyone who dies January 1st forward. It's possible that they'll change the law and make it retroactive, but we will only have a $1 million exemption with a 55% tax on the excess starting on any death that occurs January 1st forward.
You know, when you think about $1 million, I remember 20, 30 years ago when I got in this business, $1 million was a lot of money. Roberta, $1 million in California could be just a homeowner.
That's right. It doesn't take much to get up to $1 million. That is net value, so you can subtract out your mortgage. The $1 million exemption is the exemption that we had 10 years ago. So when we talk about the Bush tax cuts and the tax cuts expiring, this is kind of generally what we're talking about. We are going back to an exemption that existed 10 years ago.
I want to talk about a double whammy that applies to this. Let's just say that nothing is done. The exclusion, we know, January 1st next year, it goes from $5,120,000 down to $1 million. The tax rate goes from 35 to 55. A lot of baby boomers, Roberta, have worked for companies that have 401k programs. Some of them have built up sizable nest eggs that they've rolled over into their IRA. I wonder if you could talk about maybe some of the double whammies that could take place with people that have large IRAs as a result of rollovers from their 401ks. Not only do they face estate taxes, but also let's talk about federal and state income tax.
That's right. So if it wasn't a bitter enough pill that we're going to have a $1 million exemption, a lot of people want to tell me that their IRAs and their retirement plans are not taxable. And we talk about the difference between income taxes and estate taxes, that in fact, when you do pull out retirement plan money, it is subject to income tax. And if you die owning it, it is also subject to death taxes. So that really is a double whammy. A very obscure point of law is that if a death tax is paid on a retirement plan, there is a deduction later on your income tax return for the estate tax paid. It's only a deduction, it's not a credit, so that gives a little bit of tax relief. When we're doing, we call it end-of-life planning, when we have a client who truly is made quite elderly or in failing health, sometimes we advise them to withdraw their retirement plan money, go ahead and pay the income tax so they can reduce the size of their estate for estate taxes. So that is going to be a strategy that we revisit again as we go into this very low exemption environment.
Roberta, let me just throw some numbers out there. We know January 1st, let's just say that you're fortunate enough to have over $1 million of assets. And let's say in this case, let's take a $2 million estate. Let's just say you have $1 million in real estate and $1 million in an IRA. We know the tax rate's going to be 55%. If you throw in the income tax rate, federal, state, the combined tax rate, could it be as high as 70 to 75%?
It could be that high. The real estate, of course, would be subject to the 55% tax, but the IRA, the 55% plus an income tax of, you know, whatever, 20, 30%, there is a huge tax that would be owing. And it would be pretty much decimating that IRA if the family was trying to hold on to the real estate. So we're going back to a time when we're going to be very focused on estate tax planning, what happens at a death, trying to have enough liquidity to pay the tax. Now, keeping it in perspective, President Obama does want a $3.5 million exemption with a 45% rate of tax. So I think if President Obama is reelected, maybe we'll go in that direction. It depends on, you know, if there's an agreement with Congress. Congress has to enact the law. On the Republican side, there's talk about having no estate tax or maybe a continuing $5 million exemption. So everybody has some consensus that $1 million isn't enough. But passing a law, we don't know when that's going to happen. Is it going to be retroactive? It sounds rather harsh, but I look at my clients and I'm thinking, do they look very healthy? What I'm going to recommend might be based on their potential life expectancy. How serious do we have to be about paying this tax? And perhaps with younger clients, I'm going to say, you know, we're upset that it's going back, but let's wait and see. Is there going to be new legislation? So this is a harsh reality we're dealing with, and do we wait or do we plan as though it's definitely $1 million and we just have to bite the bullet?
Roberta, one thing that has surprised me, a lot of our clients now reside outside the state of California, and in California, trusts tend to be a little bit more ubiquitous than I've seen in other states in the country. We're running into clients now that do not have trust. I wonder if we might move on to living trust, talk about the advantage for a husband and wife in three areas. One, avoiding probate, and let's talk about that issue first. Two, doubling the estate tax exemption, and three, handling incapacity or continuity issues. So let's talk about a living trust and talk about first. Let's begin with probate and how bad that can be and costly.
I'm a California lawyer, and probate here in California is fairly costly. Between the attorney fee and the executor's commission, there could be 4% paid out. That would be 4% of the gross value without deleting any mortgages. And on top of that, we have the delay of going through our court system. And our courts now in California, the budget is being cut. One of our North County courts here in San Diego, we find it shocking. They're actually closing the probate court, and everything's going to go through our downtown San Diego court. So it means it's going to be a big load on the court system, and we can expect more delays. In a probate that goes smoothly, it usually takes about a year until there's a distribution. Where there's a living trust, that year wait is eliminated for purposes of distribution. You have a lot of things you have to do after a death, but waiting to go through the court system is not one of them. As soon as there's a death certificate, the successor trustee takes control of all the assets, and that could be maybe 10 days after a death. So it's a big savings to the estate to keep it out of probate and a big savings in terms of delay. Other states may not have as expensive a probate process as California. I've heard in other states you may be able to get distributions earlier without so much attorney involvement. So I think the reason trusts are so ubiquitous in California is because we have a cumbersome and costly probate procedure.
Let me stop you there, too, because we had a situation recently where a client was thinking of doing an estate plan. Unfortunately, they never got around to it. The individual was in an accident, passed away, assets held in his name. Surviving spouse needed access to some of the assets because obviously there's funeral expenses, things of that nature, and they were just absolutely besides themselves finding out that the assets were kind of tied up and they didn't have access to it because a lot of times you may need access to cash, you may want to make portfolio changes. And when you're in probate, just before we move on to the next on tax savings, I wonder if you might highlight that, you know, when it's caught up in the court, you're going to have to petition the court to gain access for funds.
That's right. So even if it's held, let's say, in the husband's name alone and the spouse, the wife wants access to these funds, the spouse cannot use a power of attorney. The power of attorney dies when the principal, the person who signed it, dies. And the spouse would have to petition to have access to the funds. Now, there are certain laws that do help a surviving spouse so it goes a little more rapidly, but I think easily the spouse can expect that it could take a month to 2 months until they have access to funds if they have to go through the court.
All right, so a living trust is going to help you avoid probate. Let's talk about how for, let's say, a couple today, a married couple, a living trust, we already know January 1st, the exemption is $1 million. How that exemption can double the amount you can pass from estate taxes with a living trust. Explain that for our listeners, if you would.
Well, I tell my clients a husband and wife is really two people. Don't forget that there are two people because each person gets an exemption. Each person gets a $1 million exemption. So we start with two people and two exemptions. That's $2 million to pass down to the family free of estate taxes. If you leave your estate to your spouse, it does pass tax-free to a spouse, unlimited. So you could leave billions of dollars to your spouse, no tax, but you haven't used your exemption. You haven't sheltered the $1 million amount. So when the surviving spouse dies, there's just one person left with one exemption. In order to shelter your $1 million amount, rather than leaving it to a spouse outright, you would leave the $1 million in trust for your spouse. Sometimes that trust is called a bypass trust or a credit shelter trust or an exemption trust, but it's a trust where we're using the $1 million. It can provide for the surviving spouse for the rest of the survivor's life. But it's not included in the survivor's estate. So when the survivor dies, that trust will pass tax-free to the heirs, even if it's doubled or tripled in value. It's sheltered by the original exemption amount.
So, Roberta, in this case, let's say we'll pick on the husband. The husband passes away. We have a $2 million estate. $1 million is put into the bypass trust, no estate taxes, and let's say over the next 10 years, the wife lives another 10 years, that $1 million is now worth $2 million. When the wife passes away, that $2 million bypass trust goes directly to the heirs. There is no tax on that $2 million, even though it's grown by $1
million. That's right. So that is a great thing, especially in an economy that's booming. We hope we go back to those times. So it might wind up protecting more than the exemption amount because it will grow in value.
Let's talk about, okay, so a living trust helps avoid probate, which in California can be very cumbersome, expensive, and cause tremendous time delays in accessing. A living trust for a couple can allow a couple to double the exemption. So if it does drop to $1 million next year, you can double it. Or let's say the president works out a compromise, it's $3.5 million, you can double that to $7 million. Let's talk about incapacity issues because we do see that. People in retirement today are living longer, but as a result of living longer down the road, take a look at, for example, one of our recent presidents, President Ronald Reagan, who had Alzheimer's. So you can get into serious illnesses, dementia. Let's talk about avoiding some of the problems that crop up with incapacity.
Without any plan at all, if a person becomes incapacitated, no one can sign on their bank accounts, real estate, securities, investments. So that's a major concern. If nothing's been done, the family would have to go to court to have a conservatorship proceeding and have a conservator appointed for the incapacitated person. So it's costly. It causes a lot of delay. It's very upsetting to the family. Next in line would be to have a durable power of attorney. So if a person appoints someone to act on their behalf in the event they become incapacitated, or even if they become incapacitated, with that power of attorney, the agent can take over and handle those investments. Likewise, in a trust, which is often designed to do many things, avoid probate, minimize death taxes, another attribute of the trust is that the successor trustee can take over during incapacity. So it's very important to either have a power of attorney or a living trust or both to deal with incapacity. In the trust, many individuals are their own trustee as long as they're able, but if they become incapacitated, a successor trustee steps in without needing court approval. Oftentimes we write into our trust agreements that I am deemed to be incapacitated if two physicians write a written statement stating that I'm unable to handle my financial affairs. So if the children, for instance, obtain those letters from the physician, the successor trustee can step in and change accounts to be in the name of the successor trustee so the successor can handle those accounts without having to go and start a conservatorship proceeding.
Okay, so living trust, just quick summary here. It helps avoid probate. It can minimize estate taxes and could help deal with incapacity issues. We were talking about trustees, and I want to stay on the trustees topic for a minute, Roberta, because a lot of times in either larger estates or estates where there's problems with siblings, or you have an issue where, you know, maybe the parents aren't really keen on the son-in-law or daughter-in-law, a lot of times parents will name children as successor trustees. The siblings have a disagreement. They don't get along. You all of a sudden now have sons-in-law and daughters-in-law. Let's talk about the advantage of a corporate trustee, and especially in those situations where you have a larger estate where the parents aren't as comfortable that if the children came in to a lot of money that they would have the capacity to handle it. Let's talk about corporate trustees, advantages and disadvantages.
The advantage of a corporate trustee is that they are a professional trustee. So they're in the business. They understand what to do when there's an incapacity or a death. There isn't a big learning curve or really any learning curve. They know exactly what to do. So they know they have to collect all the assets, value the assets, start their accounting. And because they know this, by the way, they don't really need an attorney's guidance very much. So that keeps the attorney fee down. So they step in quickly. They know what to do, how to handle it. And becoming a trustee for a child can be very disruptive for their life. I tell clients that it's an honor for 5 minutes to their son, Joe, who's been named as trustee. And after that, it's a lot of work. And I try to estimate about how much time goes into handling trusts and estates. And I tell individuals that whoever you name is probably going to have at least 100 hours of work just to get everything under control, figure out what's there, get it valued, set up their accounting. So it is disruptive to a child's life that they need to stop to do this. So the corporate trustee is professional, unbiased. If there have been conflicts between children, appointing a child can continue those conflicts. So I always say to people that the estate or the trust can become the battlefield for what was always sibling rivalry, and you don't really want that to happen. So the corporate trustee is unbiased. The corporate trustee does charge a fee, and generally the fee runs 1 to 1.5% per year of the net value of the trust. So many people feel, well, a child should act without compensation. but I usually point out that child is going to put in a lot of work. I recommend that the child should be compensated, and should be compensated probably as much as the corporate trustee. So I don't see that as a big difference. The disadvantage of a corporate trustee, I will say that a corporate trustee is cautious. They don't want to handle speculative assets. If there's a business involved, you have to find out, will the corporate trustee handle it? If there's real estate in a variety of states, is the corporate trustee willing to do that? Some corporate trustees are able to handle commercial and rental property. Other corporate trustees aren't.
Here's something. Let's say you have a trust or you don't have a trust. You leave the assets to a child. Those assets could be exposed to the child's creditor. Let's say, you know, you leave the assets to your son, Joe. Joe gets in a car accident now. Or situations I've seen, and I'm sure you have horror stories like this too, Roberta, where the child's inheritance is really the child's separate property. But if that child is married, and let's say you have a demanding spouse, maybe the marriage isn't on solid ground, all of a sudden that spouse says, oh my goodness, the parents passed away, he's coming into some big bucks. The other spouse talks the child to put the assets in community property, and then all of a sudden there's a divorce. The divorced spouse is claiming part of the inheritance belongs to them.
That's right. So we can set up trusts to protect the child. We can say that a trust does not end at the death of a parent, that it's a continuing trust for the child to provide for their reasonable support. And then the question is, who is the trustee of that trust? It's permissible for the child to be their own trustee, and still it has some creditor protection, still it can be protected from a spouse, but it's very hard on that child sometimes to say no to a spouse, no to a demanding grandchild, no to a speculative investment. So it is used as a way to protect the child from themselves to have an outside corporate trustee in charge. And I've seen many people who come to me with trusts for their benefit where there is a corporate trustee. And in large part, that is coming from the eastern part of the United States where corporate trustees are widely used. And they accept it, that it's being managed for their benefit. And they're usually pretty grateful that they have a trust fund that's kind of a nest egg to support them or help them out. And it can be a very nice thing to leave where the child is in charge of the trust. There's a risk that they're going to commingle those assets with their own, or there will be pressure put on them to do things that the corporate trustee will not cave into, basically.
A couple final questions, if I may, Roberta. You mentioned that January 1st, the estate tax rates can go to 55%. We know that's going to happen unless something changes. I can remember they were as high as 70%, if not higher. How do these big families like the Rockefellers, the Kennedys, I think Jacqueline Onassis passed on something like $200 million through generation skipping trust, a tax replacement trust. How do you see these big families that continue on, like, for example, the Kennedys, that have a large, large estate at a time when you have tax rates that were as high as 70%, that could be as high as 55%? What do you do if, let's say, you're Larry Lots of Bucks and you've got this large estate? Talk about just briefly that there are ways that you can minimize taxes, even for the larger estates beyond the exclusion amount.
Right. So in our generation right now, the very big estates we are seeing are the Bill and Melinda Gates estate and Warren Buffett's estate, which they're all working together to support the Gates Foundation. So family foundations or private foundations are an excellent way to help actually obliterate the estate tax, because every dollar that is left to a private foundation passes without estate taxes. In that foundation, the foundation is a corporation in itself. It holds the funds, invests the funds. The family can be on the board and the family can be paid for their services. Every year, the foundation must distribute at least 5% of the value of the foundation every year to a qualified charity. oftentimes we hear it on public radio that this and that has been sponsored by such and such foundation. So the foundation is out there guiding the use of funds among various charities for purposes that the Family Foundation wants to support. So I think that we're going to see more and more use of these foundations, which I think are a wonderful idea. Short of the foundation, there are many, many kinds of charitable giving, starting with leaving bequests to charity. There are charitable remainder trusts, where the family receives a payout for a certain number of years, and after that time, the remainder goes to charity. There are charitable lead trusts, which is the reverse of that, that there's a payout to charity for a period of time, and the remainder goes back to the family. So in these very large estates, you're seeing lots and lots of active charitable planning and charitable giving.
One more question. We talked earlier that January 1st, the estate tax goes up to 55% on anything over $1 million. We talked about large IRAs that were the result of 401ks. In addition to the 55% tax rate, the income tax rate January 1st goes to 39.6%. And here in California, the top state income tax, depending on what bracket you're in, is 10.3. So in addition to a 55% estate taxes, we have 39.6 federal income tax and we have 10.3 here in California.
That's
you know,
right.
You add all three of those taxes together. I always tell clients, without any planning, the largest beneficiary of your pension and IRA is Uncle Sam and the governor.
Right. It's shocking. And as planners, we talk about it. And when I'm really dealing with a family and they're really making out those tax payments, it seems that that's when everybody really believes it, is when the check's having to go in the mail. But it's shocking how high these taxes are going to be.
Roberta, as we close, talk about the importance of, let's say, I put together an estate plan 10, 15 years ago. Well, you know, if we just look at what's happened the last 10, 15 years ago, we've had, for the first time in a long time, the prices of real estate on the family home fell. We had two bear markets. We're in a different economic environment with interest rates at zero. Family changes, tax law changes, political changes. It's not just enough to start out with the estate plan, but it's very important you stay in touch with your planners, your estate planning attorney, because the laws are changing, the markets change, and family circumstances change. In your checkup, you know, we know health-wise, if you have a doctor, every year you go in for an annual physical. How often should you be going in for an estate planning checkup?
Well, people keep asking me that question. I say at least every 5 years. In reality, what I'm seeing is maybe every 10 or 15 years that people are checking things. So every 5 years is a good idea. And I know I invite my clients every year to a What's New seminar to keep reminding them to think about it and what's happening. One trend that we're seeing, which I'm not happy to see, but every time there's a tough economy, I'm seeing it, is children or the next generation rationalizing in their own mind why their parents need to be helping them. So if I can put out a warning about elder abuse, which I hate to see. When we're in tough times and the kids are suffering, the kids being the baby boomers sometimes, the 50-year-olds, who are having difficulty with mortgages and unemployment, and now they have their aging parents, and I'm seeing them come into me explaining to me why they think their parents should be gifting to them or paying for this and paying for that, and it's such a tough case of potential undue influence and who's the child looking out for. So I also want the senior generation to be thinking about, as you said, the selection of a trustee is so critical. And as we are living through rough economic times, gee, the children who you think are going to be so loyal and protect their parents exclusively, I'm seeing a lot of self-interest on part of the children. And so I'm warning parents to think about these rough times that their children are having to live through, and parents, to protect yourselves in the long run. I've seen a lot of loss occur where children are kind of siphoning off the parents' estate. So when you talk to Fidelity Trust, you might even want to ask them, that question, are they seeing any of this? So parents, try to protect yourselves too.
Good advice, Roberta, because we're seeing this. We have a couple of cases right now where they're really siphoning off assets from the parents because they're in trouble. One, in this case, an individual lost his job. And, you know, unfortunately for the parents, they have longevity in their family. They live into their late 80s and 90s, and it's very high risk. As we close, Roberta, I hope you'll come back and talk to our listeners again. But if our listeners would like to contact you, may I give out your phone number?
You may. My secretary might not be happy, but you may.
Okay. If you'd like to contact Roberta Robinson, the phone number here in California is 858-485-1990. And you can find out more about Roberta by going to her website. It's called Trust Law. Trust Law, all one word, trustlaw.us. And we've been speaking with Roberta J. Robinson. She's a specialist in probate, estate, and trust law. Roberta, thanks so much for joining us on the Financial Sense NewsHour.
Thank you very much, Jim.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
My next guest on our Lifetime Income series this week is Deborah Gaff. She works at Fidelity. And Deborah, Fidelity has a trust department. And I want to talk about the pros and cons of a corporate trustee. Let's say a husband and wife, they have a living trust, and they name Junior as the successor trustee, or they name their best friend, let's say John Q. Public, as successor trustee. Let's talk about why somebody would want to use a corporate trustee versus, let's say, a family member or a best friend.
Sure. I mean, we see corporate trustee use especially around accounts or client family situations that are very complex. Assets may be complex, may be kind of difficult to follow the terms of the trust. A lot of times you see an individual named as a trustee once. And once that individual knows what they need to do or what's required of them or what the responsibility is, they pretty much aren't going to be working on another trust or being named as a trustee on a subsequent trust. A corporate trustee, that's all they do. That's their job. That's their bailiwick. They are always up to date on law. They're always going to do what is fiduciary responsible for the account. A lot of times you'll see a corporate trustee named because the person doesn't want to name a family member or a friend, because they feel it may be a burden to them. They feel that, you know what, I don't really want to involve my friend or my family in the decision-making process because I don't want to alienate any of the beneficiaries in my account. I don't want to have anybody responsible for saying no to a beneficiary. You know, it's pretty tough if you're the trustee and the beneficiary happens to be a nephew or a niece, and that person comes to you as trustee and says, I am going to need to take a discretionary distribution. I'm going to have to take some money out of the account. Can you approve that? And as the trustee, I mean, now you're the, you know, you're a family member and the trustee, and the trust document may not allow for that type of distribution. And you don't want to have problems between family members. So if you involve a corporate trustee and you name a third-party corporate trustee, you kind of take that responsibility away from the family members.
So you really have somebody that's on neutral ground where you're not put in an awkward position. Deborah, what happens with the situation? And I've come across this in many cases with my more affluent clients where they're saying, you know, Jim, there's no way that my children could handle the responsibility of this amount of wealth being left to them. You know, I've got a one child who is somewhat of a spendthrift. I've got another child who's in a marriage that I'm not really sure about. It's on rocky ground. Let's talk about some of the personal dynamics of what happens to the heirs. Case one, where you may have spendthrift children. Case number two, maybe rocky marriages. Case number three, maybe creditors. So let's talk about how corporate trustees can intervene or help protect the assets of the estate under those circumstances?
Okay, if you look at a spendthrift trust, you know, if you look at if you have a beneficiary that does have money problems or there's some issues, you know, some underlying money issues, having a corporate trustee really defends against that because that corporate trustee is going to be a neutral party. They are going to be doing what's best for the current and the remainder beneficiaries, and that's their way of thinking. They're going to be very objective in that matter. They have to be. They have a fiduciary responsibility to the account. A corporate trustee, as I said earlier, does stay abreast of current law. They are very savvy in knowing how to read the document and understanding what the document means. They are going to do what's best for current beneficiaries and for the remainder beneficiaries. So using a corporate trustee may be a better way to alleviate that spendthrift burden or that spendthrift concern.
Yeah, because maybe couldn't a corporate trustee say the provisions of the trust, Junior, say that you are allowed to get the income from the trust, but unless it's a medical emergency, health-related or something, you just can't take $100,000 out of the trust to go buy yourself a new Porsche Carrera.
The corporate trustee is going to take every request for a distribution seriously. Most corporate trustees actually even have something called a trust administration committee that meets on, you know, on an ongoing basis. And that request actually has to get approved by the committee. A corporate trustee really takes that each distribution. They're going to look at each distribution and they're going to say, okay, it follows the terms of the trust or it doesn't follow the terms of the trust. And they won't have any problem going back to Junior and saying, you know, this request, it doesn't follow what the document is there for. It doesn't follow what the document has been set up for. A lot of times, too, in a spendthrift trust or in any trust for that matter, you'll see trustees actually paying or making a distribution to a company or to the vendor or to whatever the request has been made for, not to the individual beneficiary.
What about also a situation, too, as you alluded to earlier, Deborah, that, you know, let's say you have a family situation between siblings and the siblings don't get along. There's rivalry, maybe there's unforgiveness, maybe, you know, brother doesn't get along with sister. Having a neutral party there rather than, I've seen situations where parents have named the kids as successor trustee, all of them. They can't reach a conclusion. There's disagreement as in terms of what needs to be done, or they don't get along, and it ends up turning into a nightmare. It would seem to me a corporate trustee who is a neutral party, and not only being neutral, but also is an expert in terms of income tax law, trust law, estate tax law, removes also some of these burdens in problems that could potentially crop up just because of personality differences or rivalries between siblings.
Definitely. You see, a corporate trustee is going to focus on the trust and focus on all the beneficiaries. It's not the corporate trustee's job to get the siblings to agree on anything, to get the siblings to work with one another. It's the corporate trustee's job to make sure that the trust document is being followed at all times.
And can a corporate trustee, depending on how the trust is set up, let's say you do have a situation, we're dealing with one right now, where there's three children, two of the children's marriages are on, let's say, not the best circumstances, they're on kind of shaky ground, so the parents are thinking, you know what, I want to make sure that the assets are protected in case of a divorce. In other words, that it is kept as sole and separate property because, as you know, Deborah, a lot of times when distributions are made from the parents' estate to the children, a lot of times not thinking assets get commingled. And then all of a sudden, you know, 10 years down the road, 5 years down the road, the marriage doesn't work out. And all of a sudden, what used to be sole and separate property as a result of inheritance now is community property and gets put into the divorce settlement.
That's right. I was a trust officer at one point, and I do remember one case where mom and dad had set up the trust, and one of the beneficiaries, one of the sons, actually was going through a divorce, and we were responsible to get all the back information, you know, into court. We had to show certain distributions. We had to prove that we made certain distributions and how they were made. And, you know, I feel that we were able to do that because we were acting as the corporate trustee. and we had all that backup. I was able to go get that information. Pretty difficult sometimes to do that as a personal trustee because personal trustee may not be keeping that similar information. They may not have access to, you know, why a distribution was made 10 years ago. They should as the trustee, but being a personal trustee, they just may not be aware that they have to keep all that information.
Would you see, Deborah, these large estates or family legacies of very, very well-known families in the country, like the Kennedys, even the Rockefellers, you know, Fortune 500 family fortunes that were made, do you tend to see corporate trustees in those trusts when you're dealing with several generations versus family members?
You know, that's a great question, Jim. I tend to see a lot of corporate trustee. I do see a lot of clients using corporate trustees. I think it pretty much depends on the size of the trust. Sometimes they'll use a personal trustee along with a corporate trustee, and that seems to be becoming more common. I think in the past, corporate trustees really didn't want to work with a personal family member, but now they're seeing that it might be a way to bridge the gap. It's a real tough call because it really depends on what the family was used to. A lot of the older families are used to using corporate trustees because that's how the accounts were always set up.
And maybe having a corporate trustee and one family member kind of bridges that gap. The corporate trustee is up to date on all the laws, estate taxes, income taxes, the complexities of trust, but yet maybe having one family member on there kind of reassures, hey, this is the input from the beneficiaries of that trust and makes it a little bit more personable.
It does, but remember, if you're using a family as a co-trustee, they really know the family dynamic. So sometimes a corporate trustee isn't kept abreast of what's going on with, you know, all the children. One child may be doing well, another child may be ill, you know, a third child, you know, might be a spendthrift. A lot of times the corporate trustee may not always be aware of that. You have a family member that's involved in the trust, and the trust can be set up in such a way where the family member isn't responsible for distributions, so they don't have to have that burden of beneficiaries constantly coming to them and asking for money. You can still leave that to the corporate trustee, but you get that family member input, and it helps to educate the corporate trustee and really keep the corporate trustee aligned with all the family members and all the beneficiaries.
Let me throw one final situation at you, Deborah, and that is something we are starting to see a lot more now, and that is elder abuse. Let's say we're down to one surviving spouse, and let's say the one surviving spouse, let's just pick on and say it's the wife that survived the husband. And the husband was more, let's say, kept the financial records, did the investing, the wife did not. She has a lot of concern and care for her kids. She's got two kids that lost their job, and, you know, they're pulling on the heartstrings of a mother, and they're raiding the capital of the mother who could live for a longer period of time or further down the road end up, let's say, in a retirement home where the expenses are going to be much greater than where they are now. What about a corporate trustee to protect, let's say, a surviving spouse against, let's say, elder abuse?
Sure. I mean, what parent doesn't want to disappoint their child or doesn't, you know, what parent doesn't like saying no to a child, especially as they get older? It's, you know, it can be difficult to say no that you don't have money. I've seen parents go without in a family situation just so their older children are comfortable or help pay a mortgage or, you know, help pay a car loan or any number of things. Having a corporate trustee involved definitely takes that burden away from the parent. It's almost as an unspoken assistance because now the children have to go to the corporate trustee and ask for money. They're not going to the parent, and the likelihood of going to the corporate trustee may diminish because they may not feel comfortable always talking to the corporate trustee. On top of that, let's think about it. If a trust is set up, if it's a marital or a residual trust set up for the spouse, the kids aren't always going to be current beneficiaries. They're not always going to be included. So think about it that way. They have no reason to go to the corporate trustee and ask for any money. They can't. They can't get any money. You know, and even for the spouse to go to the corporate trustee and ask for a distribution, trustee's going to ask, well, what's the distribution for? And, you know, at that point, if the spouse wants to say, well, I want to give my child, you know, an extra few hundred dollars this year, this month rather, to help pay for some of their expenses, the corporate trustee is going to start to see a pattern. And if there is going to be, or if there is any abuse, the corporate trustee can step in pretty quick to make sure that that's not going to continue to happen.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of uses for corporate trustee, whether it's sibling rivalry, whether it's elder abuse, a spendthrift child, protecting assets of the estate from, let's say, unstable marriages or being distributed. As we close, Deborah, if our listeners would like to find out about Fidelity's trust services, how could they do so, please?
Great question. I'd be happy to speak to any of the listeners on our Fidelity services. We, as a matter of course, work with advisors, and we actually would name or have Fidelity named as a trustee and work with an advisor such as yourself, Jim, working on the investment management piece of it. I would be happy to be the contact person.
And if you're listening to this program and would like to speak to Fidelity or Deborah individually about trust services, you can do so by sending an email to Deborah, that's Deborah.gaff at fidelity.com. Deborah, I'd like to thank you for coming on and joining us on Lifetime Income Series and giving us some information just exactly what do corporate trustees do. I want to thank you very much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Jim.
You know, Jim, I was listening to some of the issues that you and Deborah Gaff were discussing here, and you've been doing planning for about 3 decades now, not quite, but almost there. And a lot of things are changing. You and I talked off air about that, how sibling rivalries increase. The complexity of legal structures has just gotten Byzantine. I'm sorry, that's just where it's at right now. Divorces have risen. We're seeing much more incidents of spendthrift children. There've always been trust fund babies, but this is something different here. And elder abuse, not so much in physical abuse, but in abusing how the kids use their money and how they grab it. Are you more inclined to go with a family, just having looked over all this, are you more inclined to go with a family trustee, or are you moving in the direction of a corporate trustee because that puts an impartial referee in the picture, so to speak?
John, I'm moving more and more towards corporate trustee for the very things that you just mentioned. This wasn't as big an issue, I would say, let's say 3 decades ago. Maybe it's because of the harsh economy, you know, the unemployment rate. But you mentioned one thing that we're seeing a lot of, sibling rivalry. If you think there's problems with sibling rivalry now, wait till inheritance and money comes into the picture. Literally, I can write almost a book on some of the nightmares that we've seen. Another issue that we've really seen is spendthrift children. All of a sudden, maybe the child, the parents' children aren't spendthrift, but you throw spouses in. I've seen money just, it's almost like a windfall, like winning a lottery. Next thing you know, I have literally seen situations, John, where soon as the estate is settled, it's pull the money out, they're buying a new house, they're buying cars, they're spending money. It's literally almost like winning a lottery. And in some cases, they're not really equipped to handle the large amount of money that they're receiving. You mentioned complexity. It's not just the complexity of the probate laws, the estate tax laws, the laws governing distributions from IRAs, and just even the investment complexity today. And the other thing, we literally had 2 disasters recently where we had a situation where there was a very unstable marriage. But in this case, mom is basically ill. She has cancer. So we know that she's going to pass on. And all of a sudden, that unstable marriage became a stable marriage. And the wife basically talked her husband, you know, really what we need to save the marriage is a new house. Why don't we work on this together and bring me into the investment picture? Well, what she did is she talked the son into taking his inheritance, buying a house, which they put in joint tenancy between husband and wife, so it was no longer separate property. And then also, some of the investment accounts had both their names on. because she said, well, you know, what if something happened to you? How would I, you know, what would happen? And then lo and behold, within 2 years, she divorces him. And part of what was once an inheritance has now become part of the settlement. You heard Roberta Robinson in the first part of this section where she talked about we're seeing more and more elder abuse. I have a case going on right now, and there's not a doggone thing I can do where the trustee, in this case, two children, are literally bleeding mom dry. And we're starting to see more and more of it, John. And so as a result, especially in larger estates where you have complexity, you might have charitable remainder trust, charitable lead trust, you might have foundations in addition to complex trust provisions for special needs children or children. I mean, it's just becoming more complex as just everything else in the tax laws. So quite honestly, we're moving more and more towards corporate trustees because we've just seen too many nightmares over the last decade.
You know, there is the issue of what we used to call, well, we still call it that, fiduciary responsibility. And a lot of times, there seems to be a moral shift going on in the culture that's been ongoing for the last couple of decades. People don't seem to understand what their responsibility is when they're taking care of an elder parent and also managing the money for the elder parent as well.
Yeah, I've got a case. This was a couple of years ago where the daughter was sort of the successor trustee. Mom gets a little bit incapacitated. She's got power of attorney over the assets, and she decides that she could get across town to visit mom much easier in a brand new BMW. You see this stuff, but you're right. I don't know, John, maybe it's a change. What do you think? Is it a change in the culture? But we didn't run into, you know, I saw very little of this in the 80s, saw a little bit more of it in the 90s. I'm seeing a lot of it in the last decade.
A lot of it has to do with the public education system and the shift of values in the right after World War II. The value system of Judeo-Christianity was pretty much the base of the culture. And then in the 60s, we began to see much more what I call psychosocial experimentation in the schools, values clarification, other relativistic methods. And a lot of that is now coming home to roost. We've seen several generations produced by that. And so there actually has been a shift in what people perceive to be right or wrong, as well as a shift in the ethical processes in the minds of people. So that does reflect itself in the monetary system. But that takes a lot of your own personal time. It's an effort if you're a trustee. And sometimes it's 6 months to a year, even on the simplest of things, before the dust finally settles, that you're very much busy handling the affairs of the estate.
Yeah, because you're not only handling the investment decisions, you also have to do accounting. You may have to file a 706 estate tax return. There's the final income tax return. I mean, it really has become quite complex. And then what you don't want to do is then all of a sudden, well, you know, we want to do this investment-wise. Why can't we make distributions now? Or why can't we do this? And you as a trustee have got to remain impartial and go, wait a minute. This money isn't ours yet. We have to take care of everybody's favorite uncle, Uncle Sam. We may have to take care of the governor. There's a lot of issues here, and that's why, because of this complexity, both on the investment side and also all the tax ramifications, John, we're moving more and more towards corporate trustees, especially if you have an estate that is large enough for, let's say, you're going to end up paying estate taxes, or any of the issues that you and I have been talking about, sibling rivalry, one brother doesn't get along with another brother or sister, marriages that are unstable, spendthrift children, and the worst one, sadly, that we're starting to see more and more of now, is when the sole surviving spouse is subject to elder abuse by the children. So there are a lot of issues that come to fore here. So
if you are planning on having some kind of an estate, make sure you make me the trustee and make sure that there are large provisions for fees for the trustee.
Didn't know you were in the business.
I just got there. This is getting downright interesting. Of course, we have the geopolitical situation with what's going on in the Middle East. That's being paralleled by what I'm calling the geomonetary situation, largely with the euro and the dollar, although there's some other currencies involved. We may have some ups and downs, but I think that for the most part, this is going to be an interesting fall in the Northern Hemisphere, an interesting spring in the Southern Hemisphere, and really interesting 2013, 14, 15, and 16.
Absolutely, and especially with all this money printing, and it's almost coming from all sides, John. It's not just on the political front, the geopolitical front, the economic front, all of this. You remember what the 70s were like? We were just trying to get ourselves out of a war in Asia. We had Arthur Burns, who was running the Fed, who was basically urged by President Nixon to basically crank up the printing presses. We had increase in government spending. Deficits were going berserk, double-digit inflation, high unemployment rates. And yet, in the midst of it all, in 1974, according to Richard Russell, we began a new bull market in stocks. So, John, you're right. We are going to have an interesting fall. Probably one of the biggest events, of course, coming up is this presidential election. We just got done with the conventions, but the debates start, I think, what is it? There's going to be three of them, and we start the debates the first week of October. And they're basically, it's interesting, I saw three Wall Street firms come out and change their targets in terms of where the stock market will be by election day. They're all upping their targets, but depending on the outcome, then we could end up with a major correction depending on the results. So a lot of stuff to talk about in the weeks ahead. We'll hope you'll be here to join us on the program. So on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/NewsHour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.